Prescription painkiller use has been on the rise in past decades. Iowans are trying to find solutions to the opioid epidemic. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Ben Kiefer. Iowa's Attorney General has reached a deal with the drug maker to lower the cost of an overdose-reversing drug. IPR's Katarina Sestark will be here, and Tony Lays from the Des Moines Register will be looking at stories he's covered, including a report that claims President Trump wants to deny Iowa's Obamacare fix. And Monday is Columbus Day, but did you know in some places it's also Indigenous Peoples Day? Catch your news buzz after this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Ben Kiefer today. Well, Iowans are trying to figure out how to reduce prescription opioid overdose and death. These drugs are painkillers, in some cases prescribed legally, but then taken by people who were not prescribed them. In some cases, they're stolen, sold illegally. Overdoses and deaths have risen in recent years, and now there's a new deal in Iowa with a drug maker to get an overdose reversal drug to be more affordable and available for use. Iowa Public Radio's Eastern Iowa reporter Katarina Sestark has been covering that and other news related to reducing the opioid problem, and she joins me now. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Ben.
Well, as I mentioned, there's this new deal, but first let's talk about the drug itself. Give us an overview about what drug we're talking about, what it does.
It's called naloxone, and it can be administered in a few different ways. And basically what it does is it stops an opioid overdose in its tracks, so it saves lives.
And who is giving it? Is this in a hospital?
Usually it's first responders oftentimes. It can also be in hospitals. And sometimes it's drug users themselves are administering it on people they know. So this deal with the Attorney General Tom Miller, it'll basically just make the price of that drug cheaper for public agencies in Iowa.
Well, the University of Iowa Injury Prevention Research Center was one of four injury control research centers around the country to be part of an information sharing project that was funded through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and that report came out recently. What's in it?
Well, the main thing in the report is that they laid out five priorities that lawmakers in Iowa and physicians in Iowa should look at to stop the opioid epidemic or to at least reduce it. So some of those recommendations are just educating physicians to use fewer opioids when they're managing patients' pain, educating doctors and pharmacists to help recognize the signs of potential opioid addiction so they can stop it before it gets worse. One of the things is the state's prescription drug monitoring program that allows doctors and pharmacists to share information about patients that might be shopping around for opioid prescriptions, making that more accurate and effective because right now not all doctors use it, most don't use it. Sharing more information between agencies and organizations, and also making sure that health insurance programs cover treatment for people who are addicted to opioids.
Okay, anything not in the report that they're moving ahead with?
There are some other recommendations that are coming from others like community organizations, other advocates that are involved in the opioid crisis. These are some things that were discussed at a harm reduction summit at the University of Iowa recently. So one of those things is putting a 7-day limit on initial opioid prescriptions. So if someone goes in for surgery, they can't get a prescription for more than 7 days. Making it mandatory for doctors and pharmacists to use that prescription drug monitoring program. That's something that several states have done. In Iowa, it's voluntary. Also, the Department of Public Health is talking about syringe exchange programs. So that's when someone who's using drugs can exchange their syringes for clean ones. It stops disease from spreading. Particularly hepatitis C has been a big problem in the state lately. And that's something that the state legislature would have to change some drug paraphernalia laws to allow that. A final thing is a Good Samaritan law. So if someone sees someone overdosing and they bring that person into the hospital, if that person who brought them into the hospital was also using drugs, they can't be arrested for that at that time.
Right. We should say these are all just recommendations by people that are in related industries that they think will help reduce the opioid overdoses and deaths.
Correct. And they're things that have been done by other states like Ohio, West Virginia, the ones you see in the news all the time. Those states have put in measures like this and they are seeing progress.
Okay, so going back to some of the other ideas, you know, mentioning some legislative possibilities, is there any actual evidence that something might move forward?
So a legislative committee that's studying the opioid epidemic is going to meet on October 16th in Iowa, and the report that came out of the University of Iowa will be presented to them with those top five priorities that came from a lot of stakeholders in Iowa, and then that committee will make recommendations to the governor and the full General Assembly. And they're expected to move forward with some kind of legislation next session.
Okay, that's Iowa Public Radio's Eastern Iowa reporter, Katarina Sestark. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River on Iowa Public Radio. And now to a few stories to talk about with health reporter from the Des Moines Register, Tony Lays, joining us on the line. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Ben.
Glad to have you on. And first, let's go to a story about a former Des Moines hospital worker this week that's facing federal charges after stealing a number of different types of painkillers. Let's kind of outline, first of all, what painkillers are we talking about?
It's mainly fentanyl, but it's also hydromorphone. These are IV versions that people undergoing surgery and things like that were supposed to be given at Iowa Methodist Medical Center.
Yeah, so we're not talking about pills. These are something that a doctor is giving in the course of surgery or childbirth in some cases.
Right. This is vials of liquid versions of it that you'd be given in an IV.
Okay. What happened?
And what he was accused of doing was taking the medication out of those vials and replacing it with essentially water. And then the staff, not realizing what had happened, used it to try to prevent or treat pain in patients, and the patients wound up feeling a lot more pain than they otherwise would have, is what the allegation is.
How long was this going on?
I'm not clear on how long it was. They've got about 200... There were about 270 vials stolen, according to documents with the pharmacy board.
And so in the course of surgery or childbirth, as we say, the doctor is trying to administer this pain-relieving medicine. And so are they aware that there's a problem with the medicine at that point, or is it still there?
Apparently not. A couple of the patients said they realized that they were still in a lot of pain, but apparently the staff didn't realize that the medication they were using was just water.
And was it clear at some point when something was that clearly was something going on?
Yeah, it came out last fall. He was no longer with the hospital, and he wound up facing administrative charges first from the pharmacy board, and he lost his license. And in that proceedings, he admitted in writing that he had done this. And that agreement came out last spring. So there were some patients who were pretty frustrated that it took this long for criminal charges to be filed here.
And what are the charges?
Two federal charges, tampering with consumer products and obtaining fentanyl by fraud. He's facing up to 14 years in prison if convicted of both charges.
Okay.
He's not in custody at this point.
Okay, well, we'll continue to follow that story. Let's go to another story that really has just recently had more details added to it. And I know that we've been hearing about some changes to the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, and President Trump. We've heard some reports about his desire to have these changes happen or not. What do we know?
Well, what came up this week is there's a Washington Post story that posted on Thursday based on anonymous sources saying that in August, President Trump ordered Seema Verma, who's the head of Medicare and Medicaid services, to turn down Iowa's what they call a stopgap plan, which the insurance commissioner here put forth to try to stabilize the market for individual health insurance, which is very shaky. That's the kind of insurance that people buy if they don't have employer-provided insurance or if they're not eligible for Medicare or Medicaid.
And if these changes happen, I mean, would it? Do we know it would happen in time anyway?
Well, the clock's really ticking here. People are supposed to start signing up for 2018 insurance on November 1, and there's only a six-week open enrollment period, and November 1 is right around the corner now. There's only one carrier, Medica, which is offering to sell these kind of policies in Iowa for next year under current Affordable Care Act rules. It's planning to increase premiums 58%, and for a lot of folks that would be effectively double because they were buying from another carrier that had lower premiums. This affects 72,000 Iowans who buy this kind of insurance. Most of them are sheltered from those premium increases because they are qualified for subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. But about 28,000 of those 72,000 make too much money to qualify for the subsidies, so they would face just enormous premium increases for next year. And the insurance commissioner is predicting that about 20,000 of them will probably drop their insurance and become uninsured because of it.
Okay. Well,
and that's under the current setup, if the proposal is turned down by the Trump administration.
Right. Well, we'll continue to follow that. One more story I know you've been covering, we wanted to have you talk us through, and that's Iowa's new law requiring the three-day waiting period for abortions.
Mm-hmm.
It's been upheld by a Polk County judge. Judge Jeffrey Farrell ruled Monday against Planned Parenthood of the Heartland and American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa. They sued starting in May, I believe, to try to block the law. So give us some details about the law and what the arguments were.
Well, this would be one of the longest waiting periods in the country. It's one of the strictest laws around. It passed last spring. It's very controversial. Planned Parenthood and the ACLU sued to try to block it, and they got a stay from the Supreme Court, which means that most of it is not in effect right now. So it could work its way through the courts. They sued in Polk County District Court. What happened this week is that Judge Farrell said that he believes the law is constitutional. He said it doesn't place the standard is an undue burden on women's right to abortion. This is now being appealed to the Supreme Court. It's the Iowa Supreme Court. It's worth noting that in a previous case, the same judge, Judge Farrell, in 2014, ruled in a case involving the Iowa Board of Medicine, which had written a rule that effectively barred Planned Parenthood from using a telemedicine system to dispense abortion medication to women in rural clinics. The judge upheld that rule and said it was legal. Planned Parenthood had sued. Planned Parenthood appealed to the Iowa Supreme Court. The Iowa Supreme Court unanimously reversed the judge's ruling and said that the Board of Medicine's rule was not legal, and so it never went into effect. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens here because it's the same judge, a related issue. It's going to Supreme Court again.
Yeah, and the judge did kind of hint at that in a way, saying that he said that this particular law about the waiting period is not about directly about addressing women's health care.
Right. And he also said he agrees with Planned Parenthood that this probably wouldn't drastically reduce the number of abortions in the state, that most women, when they come to the clinic, by the time they come to the clinic, they've made up their minds. And in a three-day waiting period, there's probably not going to be a whole lot of women changing their minds. He agreed with that. But he did say the state has a right to do this, and it's not an undue burden. And so he believes it's legal.
Okay, and so have we heard from Planned Parenthood and ACLU? Is this going to wind up in the Supreme Court, Iowa Supreme Court?
They obviously disagree, and they're going to take it to the Supreme Court, the Iowa Supreme Court, that it's still on hold while it works its way through the courts, so this has not been implemented yet.
Okay, well, thank you for talking through a few of the stories that you've been covering there. Tony Lays is health reporter at the Des Moines Register, and thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River on Iowa Public Radio. A number of short conversations about news stories we didn't otherwise get to this week. Well, now Johnson County in Iowa has declared that from now on, Columbus Day will be recognized as Indigenous Peoples Day. Iowa City also made the proclamation. And they join dozens of cities across the United States. Also, Davenport, Iowa's city council is doing so. Well, joining us now to talk about the significance of Indigenous Peoples Day and the long process of getting recognition for the day is an Iowa City resident who's been pushing for this move since the mid-1990s. Tracy Peterson is director of diversity programs and K-12 outreach and Native American students advisor at the University of Iowa and is a citizen of the Navajo Nation. Tracy Peterson, thanks for being here.
Yep, thank you for asking.
Of course, glad to have you on. So take us back. When did you first see a need for Indigenous Peoples Day?
Sure. So I came to the University of Iowa in the fall of 1993. And prior to that, I grew up on the Navajo Reservation in northern Arizona, on the Navajo Reservation. And really, we, you know, being in a insulated community and around people like myself, we never celebrated or even heard about Columbus Day. You know, it's mentioned in books, history books, and things that, you know, were in the curriculum. But it all came about when I came here as a freshman to the University of Iowa in 93. And that, you know, experiencing that day, I believe it was like October 11th, 1993 is the first time, you know, in my life that I've seen what Columbus Day was about and what it meant and how, you know, things were back then. And it was after that experience, which, you know, started, you know, being a part of different organizations, taking up a leadership role. I also joined the following year in 94 and really started the conversation about trying to get the university to change the Columbus Day holiday, which in 94, it's just one day back, October 10th, you know, in 94. So it was really about this, just trying to create social change. You know, at the university and as college students, we're taught that we should always, you know, find our voice and utilize our voice and, you know, create civil discourse and challenge each other to and learn and grow from those conversations. And that's what's been going on since those early times as a freshman, sophomore here at the University of Iowa. And that's when this conversation actually began.
Well, go back also to earlier in your life, and as you're mentioning, of course, weren't really celebrating Columbus Day on the Navajo Reservation, but, you know, of course, many of us learned about the historic significance of Christopher Columbus, of course, and what the exploration meant to our understanding of the world. But who is Christopher Columbus to you?
Christopher Columbus, for a long time, was a nobody to me. In the history books, you know, they've always acknowledged him as the founder or the, you know, discoverer of America. And that's all he was. It was, you know, a sentence in most books that he discovered America. And, you know, it's something that we tell our kids nowadays that, you know, your people have been here for millennia and no one discovered your people. In fact, you know, Christopher Columbus didn't discover anything. He was, you know, he was practically lost. And if anything, the Taino people and the Arawak people in the Caribbean, you know, actually found him, saved him, brought him back to life, you know, and that's where we leave it at. And this history needs to be told correctly.
And so tell me more about what it means to you then to have this new designation, the Indigenous Peoples Day.
Indigenous Peoples Day celebrates the resilience and the beauty of Indigenous cultures worldwide. When we're talking about indigenism, you know, or indigenous identities, we're not just talking about Native people. We're talking about all the indigenous peoples who were, you know, who call different parts of the world their homelands. You know, acknowledging Indigenous Peoples Day, it also acknowledges the genocide and colonization that occurred against indigenous peoples, not only here in the Americas, but worldwide. You know, we can't deny that these atrocities didn't occur. We need to embrace these past events, you know, so that healing and reconciliation can be promoted. Because if we don't, we're only promoting systemic racism by acknowledging that Columbus did, in fact, discover the Americas. And, you know, along with that, you know, in this idea of systemic racism, you know, it includes, like, the high rate of poverty for indigenous communities, the income inequality. It exacerbates the disproportionate health, education, and other social issues Native peoples and indigenous peoples worldwide are experiencing, you know? If we don't acknowledge this, and with our eyes closed.
There's a lot to recognize there in that day. And so And as I mentioned earlier, you've been sort of working on this issue for really decades. What was the process like just to kind of bring this to enough attention that somebody acted on it?
So, like I said, you know, these conversations started, mere conversations back. You know, there were some active rallying and different protests that occurred a while back. A lot of it, you know, prior to Facebook and social media, was word of mouth, flyers, and really it's just conversations with other students and other faculty and individuals who, you know, would listen to us. And again, every board, every, you know, community leadership entity changes over time. And I'm sure from that, you know, back then to now, there's probably been, you know, 5+ councils that have, you know, led the Iowa City community. And what that really means is, you know, you're finding these individuals who are also learning and growing at the same time and coming across information. And it was just fortunate from this, you know, this time around that they listened and they really want to promote social change in the Iowa City community. And, you know, again, we have to recognize that, you know, these conversations like they were back then were carried on. And even after we left the university and moved on in our professional lives, and, you know, ironically, we end up back in Iowa City coming full circle. But these individuals and countless individuals, just not myself, you know, I'm acknowledging everybody that, you know, had a say in these issues. We're fortunate that the Human Rights Commission of Iowa City heard our testimonies on November 16th of last year, which included myself, Dr. Kelly Clower, and Haley Heinshed, and, you know, the Native American student body voice at the University of Iowa, where we gathered input and pretty much shared their words with the Human Rights Commission. And it also goes to the leadership of Dr. Joe Coulter, Professor Emeritus at the University of Iowa, citizen Band Potawatomi Nation, who also led the charge in this, you know, with the Human Rights, who sits on the Human Rights Commission and, you know, provided this leeway. And so from that point up until now, you know, the board voted on this process, and there was always, you know, social media campaigning, awareness brought forefront. I mean, every community that had changed from that point on to now, we shared it on social media from the different organizations' portals. And, you know, eventually it happened here in Iowa City. We were informed, the board, the city council approved it with a unanimous vote. And, you know, that's how it came to be.
Okay. Tracy Peterson, we're almost out of time, but I hope you could give us some suggestions on what should we do to honor Indigenous Peoples Day. Do you have some suggestions?
Sure. I would definitely go attend the decolonization rally at the University of Iowa, which will occur next Monday, October 9th, on the UI Pinnacle from 12:30 to 1:30. Support the students, you know, at the University of Iowa who also passed their legislation through the University of Iowa student government, led by the senators Adriana Peterson and Jessica Owen, who wrote this legislation with countless constituents there. And they're holding a rally just to bring awareness to Indigenous Peoples Day and to celebrate it. You know, it's a trifecta. You got the University of Iowa, UISG, you got the City Council, and you got Johnson County. You know, all the supervisors there that have done this great work and countless community members. So join them on Monday.
Thank you. Tracy Peterson is Director of Diversity Programs and K-12 Outreach and Native American Students Advisor at the University of Iowa and citizen of the Navajo Nation, talking about Indigenous Peoples Day coming up on Monday. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
River to River will continue in just a moment. We'll talk about the ability of Iowa's hospitals to respond to emergencies. This is River to River.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Back with River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Ben Kiefer, News Buzz edition of the program today. In just a few minutes, we'll hear from a few of the participants in the International Writer Program at the University of Iowa, hear what coming to Iowa has been like for them. First, in light of the mass shooting in Las Vegas, we wanted to take a few minutes to examine what hospitals can do after events like that. We might generally think of hospitals as all being equal, but level one trauma centers can cover many more bases than other medical centers. Trauma centers are critical points of relief and recovery in the aftermath of events with many injuries. They're also good to have in case of car accidents and other traumatic events. Here with us to talk about Iowa's two level one trauma centers, Brian Feist, Trauma Outreach and Injury Prevention Coordinator at Unity Point Health in Des Moines. Brian Feist, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
First, talk about these trauma center levels. What does it mean to be a level one trauma center as opposed to others? What is that designation?
So our level one trauma center, it's got a couple of key points opposed to the other levels. So our first point that I like to make is that we function as a regional resource, meaning that we accept all patients from around our region to come here, get the total skill that we have to offer as we have every specialty represented. So that means, you know, we've got heart and lung and vascular care, neurology, rehab, our transplant center, hospice, and a lot of other specialties are all represented in our level one trauma center. We also provide definitive trauma care, meaning that when you come to us, we have all these specialties to be able to see you throughout this traumatic event that you've had happen, and we don't have to send you out to a different facility to get the resources that you need. So we see patients from the time they come in through the door to the time they go out to whatever, either a skills center or home, hopefully, is our overall goal. And then we also offer what my role is, where we talk about prevention and education and research. So we've got a program called Stop the Bleed, talking about mass casualty incidences, that talks about hemorrhage control. We also have our residents teach ATLS, which is our trauma life-saving class. We have TNCC, ACLS. All of these abbreviations are just classes that we reach out and teach the community as well as our own employees. And then finally, we have a minimum annual volume of severely injured patients. So not just regular patients coming to the hospital, but really critical patients that we see each year.
Well, talk, Brian Feist, about you described Level 1 Trauma Center as a regional center. So how far away? I mean, how far away might a person travel to use a Level 1 Trauma Center?
You know, we get them from all over our state. The great thing is, in the state of Iowa, we have two Level 1 Trauma Centers, us here at Iowa Methodist and then the University of Iowa. At Iowa Methodist, we have LifeFlight, which is based out of here as well as in Fort Dodge, to be able to pick up patients from anywhere around those communities and bring them into our trauma center.
So it is good to have those two trauma centers, level one trauma centers in Iowa. Does that give enough coverage to Iowans?
Yeah, I believe it does. We are definitely lucky here at or in Des Moines, because we have not only ourselves being a level one, but we have Mercy being a level two trauma center. So in lieu of recent events, if we did have some mass casualty incident happen, we would be taxed. There's no question about that. But our capability is very vast. So a lot of this is based on the amount of severely injured patients. So Iowa as a state is relatively safe, opposed to, say, like you look at Illinois, and the Chicagoland has four level one trauma centers within their radius. So it's just because they have a more dangerous environment and they see a lot more of that going on, so they have to have the capabilities to treat those patients.
All right. Well, talk a little bit more about how we decide who goes where, and there's mm-hmm. the different levels of trauma center. Of course, if there were, God forbid, a massive event in Iowa that a lot of people were injured, how we're deciding, we don't want to overtax the level one trauma center with people that don't need that level of care. So how is that decision being made?
Mm-hmm. So if we have a mass casualty incident happen, we go through the proper channels of our triaging from our EMS standpoint. So we set up a mass casualty incident. We have a chief commander. We start with our EMS providers that start looking around who's the most critically injured and knowing that where they should go. A lot of things that I saw in the Vegas shooting, for example, you had people being loaded up and then just rushed off to that level one facility that they were taken. So you got inundated by all of these people, which in our triage process, what we do is we start looking at who's the most critical and how can we help. So if you've got someone that, yes, they were shot, but they were shot in the hand, opposed to someone that was shot in the chest, that gunshot wound to the chest is going to take priority and go to the level one, where the shot in the hand could go to a level two or even a level three facility.
And very quickly, almost out of time, but can you describe what it's like to be in an emergency room when someone arrives at a hospital and a traumatic event has happened to them, they're severely injured? What's that like?
So we have a very standardized, systematic practice. So it's kind of like organized chaos. You get into the room, and there's about close to, 10 to 12 people. We have two of our resident physicians, our senior physician. We've got two nurses, our tech, and then a third nurse who's doing documentation. We've got at least one pharmacist, if not two. And then we have two, maybe three x-ray techs as well as respiratory therapists. So everyone's got a role to do. And the first thing that happens when you come into the trauma bay is
I'm going to have to ask you to make it brief. We're almost out of time,
sure,
Brian.
Absolutely. Yeah. Everyone gets quiet. EMS gives report in about 30 seconds. We transfer over the table, and everyone knows their job to do. So it's very quiet, very brief, very aggressive, and we get the person stabilized as quickly as possible.
Well, we're grateful for that and hope the resources don't have to be tested in the way that they have elsewhere. Brian Feist, Trauma Outreach and Injury Prevention Coordinator at Unity Point Health in Des Moines, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. And finally today, some conversations with international writers on our River to River program today. The International Writing Program at the University of Iowa is one of the university's signature programs, attracting authors from across the world, establishing the University of Iowa and Iowa City as a future, part of the future of American literature. In the next couple of interviews, we'll hear conversations that River to River host Ben Kiefer had with two of the writers currently in Iowa City for a 12-week writer's residency. Here's Ben's conversation, first with a science fiction writer from Uganda and then a poet from Slovenia.
Okay. So my name is Dilman Dila. I'm from Uganda. I mostly write fiction. And then I make films as well. I started out as a writer of fiction, and then I started making films because that's where there was money, and I wanted a career in storytelling. Most of what I write and make films about are in the science fiction and fantasy genres, which is, it's not unique or it's not new in my country, but it's always been there. But when I say that, people always think it's a new thing or it has come of recent, because they don't tend to associate Uganda with technology or with the future or, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you write, you make films, science fiction films. I understand you've had some quite successful pieces on YouTube.
Uh-huh. Yes. I've had a few that have been successful on YouTube, like... One has attracted about 6 million views, and it made me a bit of money.
So tell me, what is the theme? What is the story on that, your most popular YouTube film?
The story is about an adulterous affair in which there is a man and a woman. They're cheating on their respective spouses, and then they end up in a hotel room, a city hotel room somewhere downtown. And then the woman ends up dead by some accident or something. And then the man has to hide her body.
Okay.
That's the story.
That is the story. Uh-huh. Tell me, you're here in Iowa, in the United States, for the first time, or have you been here before?
No, it's in the United States for the first time.
This is for the first time.
Yeah.
What are your first impressions? I mean, you've grown up in Uganda and had certainly consumed a lot of information about what it would be like here. What are your first impressions compared to what you would thought it would be like?
Actually, what I've been reading in the news of recent about the U.S. was not very inviting. It was actually like saying, stay away from the U.S. Don't come here. That's what you see in the news. And then when I got invited to come and do this residency, my first thought was like, am I? is it really a good idea to go there? But then I decide. Friends who are, I have friends, a lot of friends who are in the U.S., and they told me, you know, it's only a few people who are making it seem like the whole of the United States is a bad place to be. So I took up the opportunity and then I came, but that fear did not leave me because just a few days before we flew, there was that incident in Charlottesville.
Charlottesville.
And so even coming through at immigrations, like talking to the your police at the border and the customs officials, I was a bit hesitant because I was like, anytime they'll tell me, no, you have to go back to your country. You can't come into the U.S. And then, but then at the airport, there was this customs guy. He asked me, what do you do? And I told him I write science fiction. And said, oh, I'm a big fan of science fiction. And then he started talking to me. And then a colleague of his was walking by and said, hey, you have to get back to work. And then...
so tell me, what is the science fiction theme that you deal with? What is sort of otherworldly or in the future that you like to write about?
Most of my stories are set in my home country and in my... which is, like I said before, is normally not associated with the future and is not associated with technology. Because there is a way the world is today that makes us think science and technology only comes from a certain part of the world, like Europe or Eurocentric part of the world. And yet there is a whole body of knowledge and which has been ignored. We look at ancient civilizations like the Egyptians, the Inca, there are those in Mali, in Great Zimbabwe, in Ethiopia, and you see the civilizations that you know existed at some point in the far past, and we see their ruins as evidence of their of what they did. But we don't know what kind of knowledge they had. We don't know what the kind of technology they had. We don't know why they were building some of those things. But because all our knowledge today is centered around European studies, we think all those were backward. So most of the science fiction I do kind of challenges this. It challenges this kind of thinking.
Tell me, yeah. You write a... You're a science fiction writer and artist, also in film, in science fiction. You mentioned aliens. Are there aliens, perhaps even aliens among us?
I think so. And I think we came from aliens, in a way. Because if you look at the mythology of many people, of many societies about creation, their creation mythologies, most of them have people coming down from the sky. And they think of those people as gods, but the thing is they come from the sky. And today when we think of aliens, we think of people coming from the sky. Yeah, actually in where I come from, there's an ethnic group called the Baganda. I read anecdotes from the missionaries who went there, and they recorded something that the Baganda believed was a method of going to visit ancestors in the sky without dying. That is the key word. There's something that they could do, and then they would go to the sky to visit the ancestors. But, of course, because these were Christian missionaries, they were writing it in a way that ridicules this practice. And so 100 years later, it looks like it was, you know, a childish myth. But maybe... these people really had a way to visit, you know, the ancestors. Or maybe thousands of years ago, there was that communication. But over time, the communication got lost. And then it became some kind of myth, you know.
Yeah.
So I think aliens, they could be there. They might have cloned us or... helped, or they might have given birth to us or something.
Okay. Maybe. Well, thank you very much for this conversation. A fiction writer, filmmaker from Uganda, Dilman Dilla, if I...
Yes.
pronounce that correctly?
Yes, that is how you pronounce it.
And welcome to Iowa. Enjoy your residency here, and I hope to speak with you again.
Oh, thank you very much.
My name is Matjaž Pikalo. I'm coming from Slovenia. I live in Ljubljana. Ljubljana is also UNESCO City of Literature since 2015.
Like Iowa City.
Like Iowa City. And I'm a poet, writer, musician, and soccer player.
A soccer player?
Too.
Do you think that the U.S. will ever win a World Cup?
You mean next year in Russia?
Perhaps.
Perhaps, perhaps. I hope that Slovenia will qualify to the World Cup, too.
Tell me a little bit, what are the themes that you you pick for your artistic endeavors?
Mm-hmm. I can tell you that I was inspired by sea. And
by sea?
By sea. I wrote... I'm a songwriter too, and I wrote in the last year 12 songs inspired by sea. Okay. And I also made music. I play accordion, and I hope that when I will come back to Slovenia, recorded it.
Mm-hmm. Does your artistic work touch on current events or news of the day or themes that we have? That people are thinking about in 2017?
Depends. But I can say that I was inspired by democracy, let's say so, or election for president in 1990, when there was first president election in Slovenia, democratic election, and by chance I was a candidate for a president of Slovenia.
You were?
Yes, I was, and we made it like a performance. I was at that time working on Radio Student as announcer. My nickname was Dr. Voice, and my logo was Dr. Voice for President.
What do people think in your homeland in Slovenia now that the United States, the First Lady of the United States, is a Slovenian, Melania Trump?
Yeah, we are proud of her, absolutely.
What else do people talk about in terms of who she is and what she brings to the White House?
Elegancy. She is a great support to her husband. And she is representing Slovenia as well.
Mm-hmm. Would you say she's a typical Slovenian? We don't know much about Slovenia. It's a relatively small country. Is she typical, perhaps?
She is, but she's also very, very, courage to go...
Brave, yeah.
Brave, to go to America, I don't know, 20 years ago. And succeeded there.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, you're here now with writers, more than 30 writers from all around the world. You're just getting to know them. I don't know, have you been in the United States before?
No, this mm-hmm. is my first time to be in the United States.
And the first time in Iowa, then, obviously?
Obviously, the first time in Iowa.
So tell us, what are your first impressions?
So, I only know Iowa campus. And it's a campus par excellence that I only wish to have when I was a student. I must not forget, I must say that Iowa International Writing Program is echoing in Slovenia right now very well.
What do you mean by that?
Information about this international writing program is all around medias, on radio, you know, on websites.
So people know, when you say Iowa in Slovenia, people know what that means?
Yes, not just from now, but also the elders remember when our greatest poet Tomas Shalamun was there. I mean, greatest contemporary poet was in Iowa City.
Mm-hmm. What do you expect to get from this 12-week residency? What are your goals? Do you have some concrete goals?
Of course. I wanted to finish or to rewrite my script for the movie called The Girl. Then I want to write a text for a postcard book for in memoriam of my friend, my best friend, Slovenian poet Aleš Debeljak. He died 2 years ago. And, of course, I want to translate some poems from my last book of poetry, You Said That You Wish, with a little help of my friend.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I know I've held you up from the nice dinner that we have prepared. Thank you for the time.
Thank you.
That's River to River host Ben Kiefer speaking with some participants of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. And that's it for our show today. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon. Help today from Robbie Broad. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. For Ben Kiefer, I'm Ben Stanton. Thanks for joining us.